Welcome to the Age Stage in this hour, I've lost count, episode. And my name's Vicky Barber, and behind the controls today we have Brody Guzet. Hey,
lost,
Brody.
I've
lost count.
Lost count. Oh, we've been going for so long during the Age Stage.
I will be in the Age Stage.
Yes, back in 19. Oh, it's a long time ago.
How was your week, Brody?
Oh, look, it was all right. It was all right. I'm glad that we finally got into that sort of that autumn weather thing, and the trees are changing.
Oh, I love seeing the changes of the trees. It brings a smile to my face, even though I am a summer spring person, but I do.
And you? What was yours like?
Well, I had Mother's Day, which was very nice. I had breakfast in bed, and that was very nice.
Yeah, miss my mum.
Oh, do you? I called my mum. I'm very thankful that I have my mum.
Yes.
She's an amazing woman. Makes me try and be a better mum.
Yep.
Now, on the show today, we have our favourite guests on All Matters Senior. We have Tom Camp and Peter Nilsson with us.
Yep.
So they'll be chatting to us about a couple of different items today.
We're looking into the effect of the budget.
Well,
that's what we're going.
Budget just came out, so I'm sure they've got a few things they want to talk about in relation to that.
Yep.
And then we've actually got a couple of pre-recorded interviews that you've actually done, Brody.
Yep.
The first is all about scamming. So that's unfortunately, there's a lot of scamming going on out there. Nearly $300 million in 2016 was lost to scammers. And sadly, a lot of that was seniors being duped.
Yep.
So we've actually got an interview with the ACCC Deputy Chair, Delia Rickard, and she has some harrowing cautionary tales to talk about or back up that story in regards to National Consumer Fraud Week, which is 15 to 19 May. And a lot of these scams come through social media, which we're all on and all over, so that'll be interesting to hear.
Right, it wasn't fun.
It wasn't fun?
No, it wasn't. Well, no, you know, it's so sad for people, you know, who thought they were doing the right thing, particularly in that sort of dating space. And it makes you wonder sometimes.
Oh, that's very sad.
About the world we live in, and do we need to think, or perhaps we need to ask someone else's opinion before you start sending any money to anyone that you don't personally know.
Yeah, well, that's it. It's the sending money, isn't it? They've groomed you by that stage.
Love. That's right.
Yeah.
And they can buy the grooming packages.
Oh,
all
goodness.
The scripts, absolutely.
Oh, goodness.
Oh, it's terrifying.
That is awful. Mm. And then our last segment, very topical. We're talking with Joy Kiriakou. I'm sorry, Joy, who's from Oxfam, great organisation. Mm. And she's very passionate about the debate about how much tax companies avoid in this country and what that actually means to our NGOs and our not-for-profits. So this was also recorded by Brody. So what's she talking about? What's Joy's?
Well, her big beef is not just necessarily just about Australia.
Right.
It is about companies all over the world. And instinctively, well, not instinctively, but they all try and hide money and say they're not making any money. And so
they have specialists that help them do
well,
that.
Well, the tax account for all these large corporations just gives it all back to the shareholders, which shareholders are happy about. But the net result on NGOs worldwide that are trying to look after famine, trying to build hospitals, trying to do doctoring things, trying to put water on that's clean, trying to provide electricity that's clean and all the rest of it, it just gets harder and harder. And what they're really saying is that the social capital that these businesses need to invest is an issue. And therefore, when you're doing your own portfolio, you should know which businesses are hiding their money, because ethical investing is growing.
Yes, of course.
So looking at it. But in the meantime, of course, the inevitable, the boys' very own walk-in music. In you come, boy.
Nice to see you both. Welcome, Tom. Welcome, Peter. It's been a little while, I think, since we've had you both in, hasn't it?
No.
No, well, Peter, you
one week.
Missed 1 week.
Went to Adelaide, did R&R, which was lovely.
Oh, very
bought
nice.
Bought some wine.
Oh, very nice.
Put on some weight.
He is looking pretty good.
Did you go to that wine, the wine museum or the wine tasting centre?
I went to a wonderful place called Ferment Asia in a little town called Tanunda in the Barossa Valley.
I like Tanunda. That's a lovely
Ferment Asia would have to be one of the best Vietnamese restaurants in Australia.
Oh, really?
It's good.
It's a big call.
Well, the Australian newspaper.
Oh, really?
Was in the top 50 restaurants in Australia.
Oh, wonderful.
It's run
by. Is that
by,
before or after you'd been there, Peter?
That was before they did that, so that's why we went, and we agreed with them.
Was it? It's was a the bill place. The top 50
no, the
bills?
Bill was, no, the bill was fine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, and it's a fantastic story. The lass who runs it is Vietnamese, mm-hmm. And her parents and she as a child were the boat people post the Vietnamese War.
Right.
Wow. And they arrived in Australia by jumping on a boat. This is, you know, back in the late 70s. And established themselves in the Barossa Valley, and she grew up there. And those her parents were gardeners, had growing obviously that style of vegetables.
Asian vegetables.
And mum was a great cook, and the daughters are now a wonderful chef. So she's got this restaurant that is just sensational. She married an Australian there who was the marketing manager for Rockford Wines.
Oh, okay.
So anyone who knows Rockford Wines, mm-hmm. you know, Basker Press and those beautiful wines. Anyway, so they have this wine list to die for. It's just an amazing wine list. But the food, it's I mean, I'm not a tapas fan, but it's little taste sensations of different things.
Oh, wonderful.
Almost
it's a sharing
degustation,
place.
Yeah.
Sharing place.
I like the,
yeah.
I like the sharing.
It's just awesome. So if you're over there,
give it a go.
You got a book. That's how busy it is. It's sensational. Yes.
And Master Thomas, have you been dining, fining, dining?
I've been dining, fining in Mornington.
Oh,
have you?
But I better not say anything too much. I can't compete with Pete over there, can I?
But there are some beautiful restaurants here
there
in
are.
Mornington.
You this is a bit of a sojourn for you pretty much every year, isn't it?
An annual event.
An annual event.
Yes.
And you bought lots of wine.
A little bit.
A little bit.
Did you drive
until
over?
Next year.
We drove over.
Oh, so you have
I was hesitant to say, I've got 4 children and 7 grandchildren. If they didn't live in Victoria, I would live in Adelaide.
Oh, really?
I love Adelaide. It's just,
wonderful.
It's a wonderful size city.
I like
city.
It as a city. I think
it's a beautiful city.
It is. Yeah.
It's got a great lifestyle. And, it's got a lot going for it.
It's not quite as pacey as here, is it?
No. No, it's...
And it's easy to get about.
It is. Well, it is for us.
Yeah.
Coming from Melbourne, the locals think they have peak hour, but it's
a You were yet to experience
it's
it.
It's a joke.
As I do breakfast programs 3 days a week, and I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the map and going, oh, it's only 75 minutes to get into town. That's only that bit of the freeway.
Yes.
And I just tell everyone to come back. All is forgiven. Now, this week, we're going to tat you on the shoulder just to cover off one little topic, unless we stick with it. But it did come up while everyone was away, and that is to do with the
budget.
Budget.
Yeah. With the budget.
The federal budget.
What's the impact?
There wasn't much in the budget for the aged care sector in terms of residential aged care, but there was something in the budget for the retirement living sector, but more importantly, for anyone who lives in Australian capital cities in those middle ring suburbs where the children have all left home and they're in big houses.
To encourage them to move on and downsize
into a more appropriate housing, not really for that reason, although that's a great reason to downsize and be able to maintain your property better, but for the reasons of the cost of the infrastructure for younger families trying to get into those middle ring suburbs, the schools, all the public transport is probably not working to its fullest because in those middle ring suburbs there's a lot of older people who just don't utilise that public purse infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So the government, in their wisdom, and I'd have to say that our industry has had played a large part in this because the Property Council for years have been agitating to give people an incentive to downsize. And the trouble with our pension system is most of the folk who are in these suburbs, because of property growth, are living in houses that they could never afford, but because they've been there for so long, 30 or 40 years, they're now worth millions of dollars, and these people are on pensions. So the minute they sell their house, they lose their pension because of the assets, income and assets test. And that generation of people believe firmly that they've earned the right to have a pension, so it's sacrosanct. They're not going to give up their pension. So
of course,
the government have been looking for ways I've encouraged them without penalising them to downsize, and they've come up with this idea whereby if you sell your home and downsize for retirees, that $600,000 or $300,000 per person of the sale price can be popped into super and not affect your assets test.
Right.
Which is a good concept. It's a great concept.
But obviously there's some actual functionality side to this.
Tom and I were talking about it. We don't quite know the fine detail. Mm-hmm. One of the issues is that doesn't come in until July 18. Talking for our sector, the average age of entry of people into a village who are downsizing people is about 76. Now, I'm not a financial planner or a superannuation expert, but I don't think a lot of those people would have a super fund, and if they didn't, they can't, because there's rules about
you
can't have a super fund over a certain age. So I don't know how that works. So there's a lot of...
I think there's some fine-tuning to go. I actually think it's more aimed at a younger person to downsize earlier.
You think?
Yeah, absolutely.
What do you mean by a younger person?
Well, a person...
Rather than in their 70s or 80s, you're talking about someone in their 50s or something too.
Or 60, 65.
Yeah, well, as Pete said, just get this conceptually. Yeah. A person that would consider moving into a retirement village, the average age is about 76.
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, going older.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are living a quality of life for a lot longer.
Yes.
And therefore, the decision-making about the time to move into retirement villages like ours may be being put off just because people are healthier and better living and more mobile, right? So what Pete's alerted to from a superannuation perspective is that there are rules around that, and from my understanding, they pretty much cut off at 75. Right? So for a person looking to move into, say, a retirement village, if they're 76, this particular option is not really the best. So when I say a younger retired person or a younger person looking to downsize earlier, the real benefit is probably in the ages between 60 and 70 when they can make use of the contribution to the super fund. What I was going to say, Peter, I think it's a first step in recognising we have a challenge about the assets of people, and I agree with you. I think it's more geared towards some of the other state initiatives around stamp duty and first home buyers, and freeing up the land in those middle ring suburbs, which, as Pete said, they've escalated in value.
I think, as is always, when you have innovative laws or policies or strategies, there's always unintended consequences.
Yeah. Yes, of course,
and they arise later. So it all sounds like a great idea off the bat, and then people start to think about it and say, hang on a minute, what about? So the what abouts are happening at the moment, I think.
So you're saying the property council, you know, has sort of worked to try and navigate this with the government. A number of weeks ago you mentioned that your industry also have some governing bodies, etc. Have they been consulted?
That's the National
Seniors Australia are the same. Like the Holy Grail is actually you get into pension assets.
Yeah.
You know, because the big thing about pensions is based around what is your asset to entitle you to a pension, and whether you're a homeowner or a non-homeowner has specific rules about that. Yeah. If you're a homeowner, for example, you might have $1 million property, but you can still get a pension. If you sold that property and moved into one of our retirement villages for around $600,000, you've got $400,000 left over, which would seriously impact on your pension.
Pension.
Okay. Yeah, you lose it.
You lose it.
Because basically you couldn't have it sitting in your bank account.
What's the sweet spot? Well, sweet spot's about $550,000, isn't it, for a homeowner?
I'm not up with those things. I'm not a planner, but
no.
But the concept from the Retirement Living Council, which is a division of the Property Council, was that same concept, but there was no compulsion to put the money anywhere. It was just a lump of money was going to be exempt from the assets test.
Oh, okay.
Exempt.
Didn't matter where it was.
No,
it was just
but the way this has been worded, you must pop it into, seems to me, you must
pop it into super. Yeah.
Which has other ramifications, like the $1.6 million maximum. You know, they put that new rule in about super, you can have a maximum of $1.6 million before they start taxing it.
Mm.
So how does that impact on that? There might be people who have, you know, $1.4 million in super and then they can't put 300 in because it tips them
then
over.
They're
that.
Over the
so there's
limit.
All sorts of things that I'm sure they're thinking about, and I'm sure there are people making, you know, representations to government about have you thought about. Mm-hmm. So there's still a bit to happen, and when the debate starts in Parliament, those things may well come up.
Well, do anyone know how many times we move in an average lifetime? How many houses?
It used to be
we buy?
Once every 7 years.
So, yes. so we buy,
used to be. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So assuming you can start, if you've got to go to start, none of my children have started yet. But
mine are still moving out of home.
Yes, mine are too.
Well, I'm not typical. I've had two houses in my adult life, so, and I've been married for 44 years, so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, because so the point was that it was done in order to free up housing for so that the tier below would move up and then that
correct.
Would leave a space at the bottom.
Yeah. It's all about infrastructure.
Which is terrific as an idea, but you know if it's for the amount of money that if you get an old person, they say you're going to go and buy units. We could be a perfectly good example. We could sell our house. We could buy a nice new townhouse. It's probably going to cost about the same, as not much off, than the current house we've got. And we won't do it because the stamp duty and all those costs are so high.
Yeah.
So if they said, if you're over 70 or something, you won't have to pay stamp duty on one house, okay, on whatever that is, then that's going to free things up for people because they're going to say, well, maybe I can squeeze that in. But, I don't think it's as easy as this making it. It's a lot of spin, I think, has gone into this.
Yeah.
And I think you're absolutely right. So you need to talk to your financial planner and see whatever's right for you. But in honesty, I reckon from what you're saying, if you're 70 and 70, you know, now, I wouldn't be waiting until this all gets resolved. I'd just continue with what you're doing, whatever plans you've got in place, because it doesn't seem any point.
Yeah.
And wait forever.
And people don't move into retirement villages because of the property involved.
No.
It's everything else that goes with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's all the services.
So don't let
the
it
community
frighten you.
And,
absolutely. Don't let it frighten you. Get into the village and enjoy it, my opinion. Not that I'm pushing villages in and out.
Well,
but thank you very much for giving me the one that you have. No, it doesn't happen.
Can I just say, it is important that they're listening.
Yep.
And it is important that they are beginning to look at strategy.
Yeah.
And I think it's a much broader social strategy, Pete. You know, for example, they've given kids the opportunity in this round of budget to salary sacrifice and save an amount of money in super. I can't see where 30 grand is going to go over 2 years, but at least it's a start.
Mm. Mm.
So at the end of the day, I sometimes wonder about, you know, what's actually feeding it all. But the bottom line is they are looking for answers. And I think if we continue to be a positive part of the discussion, then we will get actually very good policy eventually out of this, hopefully not too late.
Well, it's going to be, it's always one of those things with the government. I mean, we've got so many layers of government too in this country. We've got the same, everyone has to be their hands out.
That's a subject for the next hour.
It's not really on topic. Now, we've only really got 5 minutes left, I don't know whether we're going to get to this subject with any great detail, but I do wanted to, because it's sort of part of it. People are now coming to retirement age and they're looking at moving into villages and things. What is it that keeps the barriers to me would be, oh God, I'm at God's door now. It's all over really by the shouting. And to keep me entertained, to keep me excited.
Stimulated,
yeah. Mm-hmm. What are the new ways that villages do that these days? Surely it's not just parking them in front of a telly. I know that's to do with aged care. A lot of that happens, and it has its use. But what do you do? What have you been offered that's strange and weird and wonderful that you've implemented for stimulating activity?
In the aged care space, which is residential aged care, yes, you're right. You go to some, and the residents are all in front of tellies, probably asleep. And no stimulation whatsoever. But in the better run establishments, they And there's an obligation from the Aged Care Act to have part of your program, they call it lifestyle, mm-hmm. which are staff members, and their job is to stimulate the residents in all sorts of ways. Funnily enough, at Tea Tree, we have a lass that comes in and she calls, she's got a business, so you think you could sing, she calls the business. And there's a Tea Tree choir residents. Now, the average age of residents at Tea Tree is probably around 90.
Wow, whoa. Wonderful.
And there are over 200 residents at Tea Tree. And to be fair to say that a significant amount of them are suffering from some form of memory loss, mm-hmm. and some of them quite severe memory loss, yeah. Alzheimer's. And it brings a tear to your eye. They meet on a Thursday in the chapel and they sing, and she strums a guitar. And there are people there who go to that who don't speak but sing.
Oh,
who
really?
Have dementia, and it brings a tear to your eye. It's just phenomenal.
So when they hear the music, which is obviously from their era.
They don't verbalise, they can't
normally,
talk to you,
but they can sing
beautifully.
Sing. Oh, wow.
And that clearly comes out of part of their brain that's not affected by this terrible disease.
That's interesting because people with stutters... sing.
Yes.
And it's the moment they start talking, they stutter, but it's the moment they're singing. Yeah. So maybe it sits in part of that cortex. I don't know. That's
so getting back to the question you posed, so we've also implemented, in fact, last night we were the finalists at the last state awards. We got to one of the finalists, and what we've done, it was about innovation, and what we've done at Tea Tree is we've integrated the physio program with the lifestyle program.
Right.
And the physio program, one of the major issues for older people is the risk of falls, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and keeping people ambulant. So the lifestyle is all about clearly engaging with people, doing things, and the physio side is about keeping them as well as you can. Mm. So by integrating the both of them, like for instance, they've just introduced a program as part in the Village Glen of taking residents into putting competition. So we've got
putting as
very
in...
frail old folk
with
the physios and the lifestyle people coming in for an hour and a half and putting on the putting green.
Yeah.
And these formerly golfers who clearly can't play golf anymore, and it's just sensational.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they come into the cafe, have a coffee, so it's giving purpose again.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stimulating people.
I think that's the key, isn't it? And this comes back to your question, Brody. I think it's a very individual thing.
Mm.
I think, I'd ask you the question, if you were considering, how you do life at the moment, what life looks like for you in the next 2 or 3 years, that will determine the decision about where you go to live.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And our responsibility is to facilitate and actually build community, connectivity, to build activity for that connectivity, to give you a sense of well-being so that you feel within the capacities and the space that you're in that life is still purposeful and I have a reason to live.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think, as Pete says, that's what the better establishments do. And it's a court thing rather than actually a thing. Mm. Isn't it? It's a spirit or an ambient around the village that you
create. So don't be afraid to ask. If you're going to go to a village, the message I would take from that is...
is what's on offer.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's what's on offer, but
it's more than that. We spend much of our time helping you define what it looks like. Much like a financial planner sits down and works out your money to be able to do your thing.
Yeah,
our job, very much it's a social responsibility we have, is sit down and say, well, what does your life look like in the next 20 years? What are the limitations that you foresee, See, we get a lot of people come to us that are pushed to us because of health issues. So we tailor program around making sure that those health issues are dealt with and facilitated to obviously have the best quality, whether it's nutrition, whether it's exercise, whatever.
Mm.
So they are the important questions, not so much asking us what we offer, but it's what are your expectations, what are you looking for, and then we try and come together with you and say, well, this may be the place that can deliver and meet those expectations.
Well, it's, all you've got to do is ask. And I've got some good news for you, by the way. This show... which you are the foster parents of, we had a call last week, and we had Sam Dickinson in, and somebody said, I avidly listened to the show, and I would like to talk to her, if I possibly can, about stuff to do with
funeral planning.
So there you go. Yes.
How good's that?
Yep, happens, comes in. This is the way it goes. Now, we have to go, unfortunately. And the reason we have to go is because your time is up. And we have
pumpkins now.
No, but next week we'll explore but we lose Vicky this next week. She's away for 2 weeks.
You're away for 2 weeks.
Yes. So there's going to be me.
It's going to be Brody. Okay.
Brody, we'll make it happen. The boys are back in town.
Stuart sends his apologies today and next week, so it'll be myself and Tom.
Terrific.
Next week.
Lovely. Right.
You happy to have me, mate?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. I love listening about Adelaide and the nice wines he's brought back. And
talking about dancing, let's go out with a bit of dancing from ABBA. And welcome back to the A Stage. Now, the next part of the show today is part of a pre-record. As we said in the beginning, it was done on the breakfast show, and it involved the deputy chair for the ACCC, Delia Rickard, who gave us some really cautionary tales about what's happening in terms of fraud and the problems that it's causing some of the seniors. So have a listen to this. I think you're going to find this really quite disturbing. And good morning. It gives me great pleasure indeed to talk to this morning with Delia Rickard, who is the deputy chair of the ACCC. Now, that's a fairly serious person to be at the top of an organisation, or at the top echelons of an organisation of the ACCC. So to have an issue which covers the problem of scamming and its effect upon the Australian society, it means that they must be taking the issue very, very seriously indeed. So we're going to find out a bit more about it this morning. So good morning. How are you this morning, Madea?
Good morning, Brody. I'm terrific. And we do take scams seriously because they do a huge amount of harm. Last year we saw at least $300 million lost to scams in this country. And that causes both financial devastation, and with some of them, particularly the dating and romance scams, it causes huge emotional devastation as well. It's a huge cost to the community and a huge cost to the people involved.
Well, the old scamming used to be the chap from Nigeria who would say, you've just won a diamond mine, please, you know, we've got $50 million, we'd like to send you, please send your bank accounts. But now it's got very much more up close and personal, hasn't it?
That's exactly right. I have to tell you, so we've just sat on a diamond mine type scam, still exist, and people are still losing millions to them, and some of them still arrive by letter. So some of the old school ones are still around. But one of the big trends we saw in 2016 was scammers had moved onto social media, in particular onto Facebook. And the sense we have is that people really aren't expecting to see scammers there, so their guard isn't up. And we've had 9.5 million in losses to social media scams reported to the ACCC last year. The two big ones being dating and romance scams again, the most profitable of all scams for scammers, and also fake online shops, which was the one scam category where younger people under 25, were most likely to be the victims.
So it's shopping for the young folk. Is the dating a senior citizen problem?
Scammers prefer older people. They prefer people above 55, at least above 45, and they are the ones that they target. We think it's because by that stage of life, you've accumulated some money, so there's something for them to get their hands on. They also know that that's the time when people, there may be divorces, children leaving home, bereavement, people are possibly lonely. And what we've seen is on Facebook in particular, they'll have check out people's profiles beforehand if the privacy settings aren't secure, and then they will approach with a friend request. And they will, if you accept that request, they will very quickly connect with you because they already know your interests, so they know the things, you know, the way to start a conversation with you. They'll move you off the site because Facebook does have a lot of good scam detection processes in place, and then they will develop normally a romantic relationship, sometimes just a very, very strong friendship, and eventually they will ask you for money. And the bottom line is, if you've met someone online, you only know them online. No matter how well you think you know them, no matter how close you feel that relationship is, if they ask you for money, it's going to be a scam. Don't provide it.
Well, I know. That makes such logical sense. It's so painfully obvious. So how does it get under the radar? So what is it that people ignore that advice and just find themselves on this dreadful spiral? Because it goes on and on, doesn't it? It's not like, send me $50 and then I'll never speak to you again.
No, it goes on and on. People lose their homes over it. They borrow from family and friends, and not only can they not pay them back, they lose those relationships. Children don't talk to parents. It's terrible. Look, I think it's a few things. I think, first of all, this day and age, we all know people who have terrific relationships with someone they've met online, usually through a dating site. So it's not impossible to find love online. Secondly, the scammers are just so good at what they do, and they tend to start to isolate people from all their normal support networks. They build this beautiful romantic bubble around the two of you. They will contact the person multiple times a day. They will make them feel appreciated, loved, understood, more than they've ever felt in their life. I've spoken to many victims of these scams, who even now that it's over, they know it was a scam, still will say, it's one of the happiest times of my life. I miss those calls daily. So I think I haven't ever been part of one, but when I speak to people, it's very clear that they sort of cast a spell over them.
Yes, what an awful thing, though, to be relieved of all your money, to know that you're at the destitute end, you're an older person, and yet still hang on to that feeling that they were the happiest days of your life. That is so dreadfully sad.
It is.
Let's assume someone has got themselves started along that route. What do you suggest they do?
Cut off all contact. Absolutely cut off all contact. You may need to change your email address and don't respond. If you think that a family member or a friend has got involved there, try talking to them. We've often found that even sending the police to talk to them and tell them being scammed doesn't work. One thing we have seen work a little bit is seeing the stories of other victims. So on scamwatch.gov.au, we've got a whole lot of video clips from a range of TV shows and others where victims who've realised they were scammed tell their stories. And often it's hearing another victim's stories, because there are very common elements to all of them, that starts a question mark appearing, and that starts to dismantle that trust that the scam has built up.
It would be, I know this is sort of out of field a bit, but it would be terrific if there was a number that you could call, a bit, you know, a bit like Lifeline, where you could say, look, I'm so embarrassed about this, but I don't know what to do now, where someone can take you gently and wean you off this affection.
And I think
affection.
You can call Lifeline and that to talk to them and have that chat. And there's lots of material too on scamwatch.gov.au.
Right.
Or go and speak to a counsellor. Look, it is a very difficult area and sadly, you know, an under-resourced area.
Now, if you think, so if what would I be looking for if I was a child of somebody that you think might be, like a parent, for example? Let's assume I've got a parent, my mother died, and my father's out on his own. What signs would I be looking for?
If they're distancing themselves, if they're looking forward to phone calls, looking forward to emails,
right.
You might ask if they're in their relationship. If they say yes, one of the things I would do is get the profile picture of the person that they're involved with,
mm-hmm.
and put it into Google image search, because the scammers often take photos of you know, US Army generals, people in suits, and do that, because you will often find then that it's in fact not,
right.
Who they say they are. Sometimes even just putting some of the flowery language they use into Google,
yep.
will show that it's been used over and over again, because these scammers can buy scripts, 6 months worth of scripts for romancing someone. Obviously, they need to personalise it and add certain elements. Just talk to your, look at the information on ScamWatch and talk to your parent about some of the common traits. Have they moved you offline very quickly? Often with Skype and things, their camera's never working, so they can see you, but you can't see them. Are they contacting you 3-4 times a day? Just go through the characteristics that you'll see in all the scam stories on ScamWatch and try talking to them. It may also be a good idea to talk to their bank and say, look, we think she's being scammed. We don't want her sending money. Now, the bank might then have a conversation that you can direct the bank not to send it, but you can put them on notice so that they can also have a conversation. It's a difficult chore, but it's really, really important to do it.
Yes, because you're playing with somebody's feelings, and it's particularly if it's someone in your family, and then, of course, they're just going to look at you and say, you just want it yourself, don't you? It just goes round and round in circles. Delia, Rickard, it's been great talking to you this morning. I think ScamWatch is a terrific initiative of the ACCC, and I had no idea that the ACCC held it as such an important challenge to our social fabric. And so if you, in the final process, if you feel that you may be being scammed, if you feel you're going down that, you've maybe handed out some money and you need someone to talk to, then call Lifeline or any one of those services or Beyond Blue and say, look, I'm feeling a bit concerned about this, and we'll see how we can take it from there. Delia, thank you so much for being on our program this morning, and we look forward to talking to you.
I appreciate it.
Talking to you soon. Bye-bye. Well, that's something for us all to take care of. So, in terms of think about, if you've got a parent or a grandparent or something that suddenly is starting to look lovey-dovey, gooey in the eyes, I think you'd probably need to ask the question that they've been maybe going onto a dating line and maybe finding themselves in a little bit of trouble. But it's not necessarily dating either. Sometimes it's just they think that it's a really good cause and then someone's fleecing them. So have the conversation. That's all I can say. Now, next one after that was again one of the shows that we recorded earlier, and this one is from Oxfam, and Oxfam internationally are concerned about corporations that are perhaps not spending giving away enough of their taxation money. In other words, they're hiding it offshore, and that is not just a problem for Australia, but it's a problem for businesses all over the world because the NGOs get hurt. So without further ado, let's listen to Joy Kiriakou, who is from Oxfam, and she will open the debate about how companies are avoiding their tax and what that means to their businesses. And welcome to RPP. Now, I have a great pleasure in bringing to the station today Joy Kiriakou. Did I pronounce that correctly, Joy?
Quite close.
Kiriakou, my apologies. Now, Joy is from Oxfam, and she's sort of on my team a bit, I reckon, because Oxfam have issues with the way that corporates seem to be avoiding their taxation responsibilities. And the reason that they're into this is not because they're particularly against corporations, far from it. But the knock-on effect of the amount of money that could be collected but isn't in this country does have effect upon NGOs or non-government organisations or non-for-profits. Am I reading it that way, Joy?
Look, you are, and that's absolutely right. We have no problem, of course, with corporations, but what we do have a problem with is where taxes are being avoided. Because taxes equals money that could be spent on schools, on hospitals, on essential services, on things like vaccinations and the other things that everyday people need. And the big problem with that is that, of course, it means that Australia misses out, but it also means that when we're talking about big multinational companies, people in the very poorest countries miss out as well. And that's really the big concern for Oxfam.
Now, your people wouldn't just make this statement unless they'd done some serious number crunching. What do you assess the missing funds to be?
So we assess them to be in the billions, in fact.
Did you say billions?
Billions.
Wow.
So we estimate that annually for Australia, we estimate that they're missing around about, in Australian dollars, 5 to 6 billion from our coffers. And then from developing countries around the world, the figure is much bigger. So globally, developing countries around the world are estimated to lose over $170 billion annually due to the tax avoidance practices of multinational companies, and particularly the use of tax havens. And we've also done some number crunching, particularly for the way that Australian-based multinationals are shifting funds around. We estimate that particularly Australian-based multinationals are contributing about $3 billion to that figure.
Now, they would claim, of course, that they have every right within our law structure to be able to do this. Otherwise, they wouldn't do it. And they say that it's in the interests of shareholders, and that's why these large organisations do what they do. What? How does Oxfam cope with that message?
Well, there's different levels of legality, I guess, and morality amongst all of the different ways in which large companies can shift money around. And that's right, a lot of it is perfectly legal. But that doesn't mean that it's ethical, and it doesn't mean that it's right. So we would argue that any business needs to take a view of what's sustainable for their business and for the countries they're operating in into the future. And a sustainable business needs to think about not just absolutely 100% profit all of the time, but also about the footprint that they're leaving. And the sort of infrastructure that they're leaving or not in the countries that they're working in. So that's the sort of thing that we'd really encourage businesses to think about. And some responsible businesses, you know, do take that view and are starting to take that view more and more.
Now, in the share space, in the shareholding space, ethical investing has become more and more prevalent in the recent years. Is it Oxfam's responsibility to potentially find a way by letting Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Mr. and Mrs. Average, know which companies you believe are not meeting their social financial responsibilities so that they can make choices? Because they may not be able to do that independently.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wish that we could do that. But a big problem that Oxfam has is that while we can look at global financial flows, and the International Monetary Fund publishes global financial flows of transactions every year, and that's what allowed us to really analyse that data and come up with the numbers I spoke to you about earlier, the billions that are missing, all of that is de-identified. So what we don't know, and what it's very hard to find out, is exactly which countries, companies are doing what. So what it really takes is whistleblowers and, you know, extremely expensive large investigations like the Panama Papers investigation to come up with which companies are actually doing this activity and skipping out on the funds they should be paying, especially to poorer countries, but also to countries like Australia. What we've been asking for is for the Australian government to introduce legislation called public country-by-country reporting legislation. And that legislation would require large multinationals that operate from Australia to publish their taxes paid, the number of staff they have, and their profits for every country in which they operate. Now, some other jurisdictions, like the European Union, do have this legislation already, but it only applies to high-risk sort of companies like banks, and for some jurisdictions also mining companies. But we'd like it to apply for all really big companies. And it is something we're quite pleased to say that in the budget reply, Federal Labor did commit to supporting, which we're quite happy with.
Yes, certainly that did open up a big debate. Clearly, our government has elected to give the banks a bit of a nudge and say you're going to have to pay a bit more than you anticipated, which has made them cough and splutter. But as you say, it comes down to, and I'm not naming these as specifics, But large organisations that are international, like Google or like Apple, when they always come, they're the ones that are trotted out. And yep. I think it's fair to trot them out if they come into the spotlight. The question is getting the spotlight, isn't it?
That's right. The question is getting the spotlight and shining it on the activities of these companies, which is something that not only is helpful for, you know, the general public and the civil society organisations to understand what's really happening. It's also helpful for journalists, but it's helpful for shareholders as well, because then they can see where the companies they're considering investing in are actually making their investments. And if you have to publish things like your number of staff in a country, any country, as well as your profits and the taxes you pay, what it allows shareholders and others to see is whether you might just actually have a post office box in that company, in that country, as is the case with a couple of different companies in Bermuda, for example, or whether you really have actual business activities occurring there in these particular tax havens and so on.
Well, I think it's very brave of you to stick your head over the parapet, because working on the ethical investment area is not an easy road to hoe. You do work with mum and dads. They're the ones that have been the backbone of Oxfam for many, many years now. And it's their pennies that have made a huge difference. But on the other hand, we can't ignore that the corporate requirement to be part of the social fabric and part of the social responsibility is something that we need and we should do in Australia, because it's the sort of people that we are.
Yes, that's right.
Joy, it's been an absolute privilege to talk to you today, and I look forward to seeing how the issue progresses with Oxfam, and maybe we'll hear more about it in the government discussions as in the not too distant future.
Thank you. It's been lovely to speak to you, and I hope so as well.
Thanks very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's the end of my lot for the day.
Thanks, Brody. That was great. Now, I'm away next week.
Oh, yes, you are.
And the week after.
Oh, yes, you are.
But then you're away.
Well, yes, that's true.
Yes. So while I'm away, don't find anyone to take my seat, so to speak.
Well, I won't.
You won't. Thanks for that. But yes, I do look forward to coming back in a couple of weeks and catching up on the age stage.
Well, I hope that you're going to have a fantastic time while you're away.
I will.
And we're actually going to share a Bali story
when you
get. Well, I may even call in from France, because around about this time, is there a possibility to call in?
Oh, that would be fantastic.
So we might try that. Anyway, lovely to see you. Have fun, and see you in 5 weeks.
Oh, goodness. I shall miss you.
You too. Bye. Take care. Bye.